Thank you. My name's Keith. I'm an alcoholic. See, boy, what a great way to start a day, huh? I want to thank the committee for inviting Julia and myself to be here with you this weekend. I've really looked forward to this. What a beautiful hotel and everything. My goodness. I wonder if they have any idea what they're doing. I was thinking this morning, 950 recovering bedwetters. In a 5-star hotel. There are advantages to everything. You know, if many of us hadn't been bedwetters, we would have burned to death before we had a chance to get sober. I was kind of impressed with the fact that there were 1,000 dozen cookies of AA, at this AA conference, and there are 950 members, and I won't eat any, and my wife won't eat any, and if you look at John and Ray, they don't eat any cookies. A lot of you are eating a lot of cookies out there. It explains the energy level in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've looked forward to this. I've come to Hilton Head on numerous occasions. My brother, I'll tell you a little bit about my brother later, but my brother owned a place down here. And so I got down and got to a lot of meetings, and some of the finest meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever been to. I used to go to the Wednesday night group over to, is that St. Luke's or some church? And a wonderful time. They gave me a visitor's chip, just all sorts of nice things. So it really is a pleasure to be here. And it's a pleasure to see so many friends. I had just a bunch of guys from Fayetteville, and just delighted to. I know Chris comes here just about every year now, and David's been here, and Ted and Charles are here for the first time, and I'm just really pleased about that. They're here to make sure I tell the truth. They'll go back and tell on me, so they're a sick bunch. They won't remember till Monday, so. And I'm glad my wife Julia's with me, and we have a bunch from Indiana. Stay away from them. I was impressed there were 26 states or something represented here. It's just amazing. I travel some now, and that always astounds me because I remember at the end of my drink and I couldn't get out of my apartment. And it was one room. It was a one-room apartment in the basement of a dive in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., and I couldn't leave the place. I wanted to. Usually every day I'd make up my mind I was going to leave. I was going to, just sort of bust out and do something like get the mail or try to go to work or something. And I just couldn't do it. I mean, I take me till noon to get out of bed, and then I'd sneak and peek out the curtain to see if they were out there. And I couldn't see them, but I knew they were. So I just decided, well, I'll do it tomorrow. And then to travel and run around and things like that we do. It's truly freedom. I'd like to start off by saying I'm not sure of anything I'm telling you because over the years I've really found out how wrong I've been. I think it's one of the great gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've received is the fact that I'm wrong. And I'm glad I am about a lot of things. Ray and I were talking about it last night at dinner, and I had I got in touch with my child within shortly after I was sober, and what I found out was it was an unruly, undisciplined little bastard who needed to be talked to. And I grew up in the Ohio Valley, and I'm Irish, and I have 10 brothers and sisters, and I won't tell you what church I went to. You're going to have to guess. But I give you a hint, it had something to do with bingo, but I'm not going to say any more. And I was really sort of a strange kid. I got into a lot of trouble when I was in high school in particular. And if we'd have had any money, we were kind of poor. If we'd have had any money, I'd have been what's termed an acting out adolescent. But we were poor, so I was just a punk. And I was always in trouble. And they used to tell me it's because I wanted attention. I don't know if that's true or not. People tell you a lot of things. But when I, after I grew up and I would be sitting in a bar someplace in Washington, D.C., and and you ask me what happened to me, and I tell you it was because I was raised in poverty, and my father never told me he loved me, and my child within was suffering something horrible. And you know, the reality was I was a punk. That's my problem. And I couldn't help myself. I do things. I didn't mean to do them. I remember in high school, one of the things I had to do for detention was to clean the rubber man. Remember the rubber man, Adam? Everybody had an Adam in biology class, and he didn't have any head or anything, and you'd take his chest off, and then you'd take the organs out. Remember that? They'd be rubber, foam rubber. And the nun would take them out. Oh, I'm giving more hints, but the nun would take these organs out, and you had to name them. And one of the things I had to do was arrive early at school and wash Adam. And I was washing Adam, and I realized, I ran down to the home ec room, and I got some yellow food coloring, and I made up a yellow solution, and I compressed his bladder, and filled it up with this yellow solution, and Sister Regina was going through the Adam and pulled out the bladder, and this yellow substance ran out of his bladder down her arm into her habit, and I don't know what made me do those things. I used to serve detention in a library, and had a nun in a library as a librarian. Sister Victoria is one of my favorite people ever lived. And Sister Victoria used to run around, very strange woman. She'd say things like, "Every boy's a prince and every girl's a princess, because we have a father who's a king." And so we'd get behind her back, and we'd have Princess Mary and Prince Keith and things like that, and laugh at her, you know, this strange woman. And she used to parade around this library like it was a library of Congress. And I didn't understand, but Sister Victoria had the strange notion that if you were doing God's will, you were always in the perfect place. And I used to spend a lot of time with Sister Victoria. We'd do our detention there. And she used to, we had to make rosary beads. You know, for you heretics, those are the things that Catholics pray on. And they're made up of decades. There are 10 beads in a decade, and there are 5 decades, you know, on each rosary. And I used to make them with 11 beads on a decade. And they would take these rosaries, and they'd send them all over the world to the missions. And so I spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria, and by the time it was time for me to graduate, there were literally thousands of mutant rosary beads all over the world. And she never caught on, and you can't let stuff like this go without mention. So I set her down before I graduated, and I said, "Sister, you know what I've been doing?" And she said, "Yes, you sly little prince, I know what you've been doing. You've been putting an extra bead in each of the decades and all the rosaries you made." And she said, "I also know why you've been doing it." And I remember thinking, "God, I hope she tells me, because I have the foggiest notion of why I do these things." She said, "You're doing it so that people all over the world will pray extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit." Don't you hate people like that? You know? You know, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous a very short period of time, and I used to bug the old-timers. If you're kind of new, I'd like to give you some information. You know, it's like everything else, it's just a suggestion. But you heard John last night, you'll hear Ray tonight. They're old-timers, and I'd suggest you kind of stay away from them. Old-timers aren't well people. They're really not, and there are a lot of them around here. I can tell, you can spot them, And they lie a lot. They tell you things like, "I keep coming back to meetings because I have to." And that's a lie. They don't have to come to meetings. They come to meetings because the only pleasure they have in life anymore is watching people like you and me suffer. It's the truth. And if you don't believe me, go up to one of them after the meeting and tell them a problem. And, you know, the first thing they do is laugh. Whenever you tell them a problem, they laugh, and they'll laugh at your problem. And if you want them to have a good time, you want to have a real good time, tell them a problem about sex. They love they love problems about sex. See, they aren't having sex anymore, and they don't want you to have it either, so... But anyway, I went to this old-timer, and I said to him, I said, I'm having this problem. I forget what it was. I belonged to a group of guys who met after the meeting. We were sort of the problem of the month group, and we'd sit around and criticize everybody, and you know, the normal stuff that the really elite do in AA, you know, the intellectually superior bunch who aren't dumb like the rest of you, and we come up with a problem, and we had a theory that if you had a problem, you didn't get an answer to this problem pretty quickly, you had to drink. Now, that's serious stuff. So they always send me to get the answer from the old-timer. I never wanted to do it, but they were all bigger than I was, and so I went to the old-timer. And you know what he said to me one day? He said to me, he said, look, I want you to get some lipstick from one of the girls in the program. And he said, I want you to go home and write on the mirror, Keith, you are wrong. And I said, well, you know, I can't do that. You see, my problem is I have a poor self-image, and I have to be affirmed. Don't ever talk that way to an old-timer. They hadn't read any of those books. So he said, look, boy, I said, all right. So I didn't want to owe anything to anybody, especially a woman. So I went and bought a tube of lipstick, and I went home, and I wrote on my mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And, you know, in utter disgust, I threw the lipstick in a trash can and went on to bed. And remember a normal night when you had about 60 days? Remember that? Oh. You know, you'd lay there and you'd close your eyes, and for the first time that day, my mind would wake up, and it would take off. Remember that? You're never going to make it. They're going to find out what a phony you are. You're probably not an alcoholic. You're really crazy, and on, and they don't like you anyway, and on and on. And then, you know, and then finally I drift off to sleep, and then the leg cramps. Remember the leg cramps? Oh, leg cramps only happen when you're asleep. And they bring you out of a deep sleep and all this stuff and the sweat. And then about 15 minutes before the alarm clock would go off, I'd fall deep into sleep. You know? Then it would take 2 clocks to wake me up. And then I'd wake up and depression would be waiting for me. And my mind had never stopped. It was still talking to me and everything. And I went out in the kitchen to make coffee. And my mind was telling me, you know, you're going to go to work today. And they're going to find out you don't know how to do your job. And, you know, I was near tears. I was so depressed and it was so bad. And I walked in the bathroom and it said, Keith, you were wrong. And I said, well, thank God, because if I'm right, I'm going to have a lot of trouble. And that's the great lesson that I learned from Alcoholics Anonymous. I was wrong. I was just wrong about stuff. I mean, I didn't see it the way other human beings saw it. And so what I'm going to tell you, I don't know if it's true or not. To the best of my knowledge, it is. The last time I checked, it was. But who knows? Next year? I like to talk about my first drink. I think it's important. A lot of people don't think it's important. But I think if you don't have your first drink, it's real hard to become a real alcoholic. There are people who try, but it's hard, and it's really hard. And so I like to talk about my first drink, and it wasn't traumatic, it really wasn't. I was 5 years old, and my brother Denny was four, dumb Denny. And my father was watching us, my mother, I don't know, she's having a baby or at the bingo or something. And there was rarely alcohol around our house because both of my parents had alcoholic parents, and so they rarely had alcohol around. But there were a few beers in the refrigerator. I'll never forget this. My father got us each a beer. I guess he probably thought it'd be kind of funny, you know. And we drank our beers sitting around the kitchen table. And I was fine. I mean, I was just fine. But old Denny, I looked over and Denny was sliding out of the chair. And he was rolling around under the table. And he was singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs. And my father panicked, and never forget, he wrestled Denny to the ground, and he got his clothes off him, and he put his jammies on him, and he was carrying him up to bed, and Denny was laughing and carrying on and singing and everything, and he said to me, son, get ready for bed, and I said, okay, Dad, and I got ready for bed, and I got in bed, and I was watching Denny, and Denny was jumping around, just having the best time, and my father said, don't tell your mother about this, and I'll take you to the movies. Well, I was a pretty cooperative kid, but Denny wasn't hearing it. He was just having the best time. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. I looked over, and old Denny was standing up in a crib, and he urinated on the floor. Never forget that. And I remember laying there watching this kid thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. You know, the saddest thing happened to Denny. He just never made it. You know, I mean, he's one of those people with a lot of potential, and he just never developed it. He just sort of like quit. He grew up, and we're not proud of this, but he turned into a very strange guy. I'll give you some examples. Denny went to one college. He had one major. And he graduated on time. And he went to one graduate school. And he was a 4.0 student, and he graduated on time. And he had like 7 or 8 job offers, and he picked one. You know? And he's been working for this company. It's 25 years now. He's a vice president in this large international corporation. And you know the strangest thing of all? He's had one wife. Now here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old. And just let it slip out of his hand, you know. I had to work at this thing. I was 23 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor. I got out of high school. That's still the speculation on the part of a lot of people. But I got out of high school and. I had an old idea that I was supposed to know what I wanted to do. I don't know where I got that idea. I thought that everybody in the world knew what they wanted to do but me. And I didn't want to be around the people who knew me when they found out I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I went home and took an inventory, and I took my shirt off, and I stood in front of the mirror, and I flexed my muscles and everything, and I was 5'1" tall, and I weighed 113 pounds. And whatever else I was a born killer. So I went over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and joined the Marine Corps. And I never forget that. My mother was just in hysterics. She was up all night singing and crying and saying, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my father was saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." And that was a speculation in the Lewis household. The next morning, I went over and got on a bus and went to Pittsburgh, where I was going to have my physical and be sworn in. It was 60 miles away. It was the second longest trip I ever took in my life. Once I went to Cleveland, but the game was rained out. And I was a bad year, and they took anybody who could breathe. And that afternoon, I was sworn in the Marine Corps. And I was terrified. I mean, I knew nothing about anybody. The only thing I knew about the Marine Corps were they brought a certain number of people down here and drowned them in a swamp. That's the only thing I knew. But there were 3 guys from Pittsburgh, and they understood the big picture. I mean, you know, they were filled in. They knew what was going on. And I was the only one who didn't. And so I learned to follow around people who knew. So I followed these guys, and they went to a bar. We had about 8 hours till the train left. And we went to a bar in Pittsburgh. I don't know if you've ever been in a bar in Pittsburgh, but I'll tell you, it's something. It's filled with real men, you know, the kind with tattoos, and you know, they spit on the floor. You know, they knew words that I didn't know, and all of them had a real woman with them. You know, real women hang around with real men, and guys like me got what's left. And I followed these guys in the bar, and they sat down, and the bartender came over. He's a real man, and he said, "What do you want?" And you know, the way I thought was, "Oh no, a quiz." I had no ideas. It's like, I sort of thought life was like, you know, you'd be sitting there one day, and when you least expected it, somebody would say, "Take out a blank sheet of paper and put your name in the upper left-hand corner." And there's going to be a pop quiz, and I hadn't studied the right stuff. That's the way I thought about life. And I had no idea how to answer this question. So I looked at the other guys, and they all ordered a beer, so I did too. And then they ordered another one, and I did. And when the guy came back the third time, I knew the answer. I mean, that was a quick study. He said, "What do you want?" I said, "A beer," and hurried up. He said, "Yes, sir," and he left. And somewhere during that third beer, my life changed. You heard John talk about it last night. My life changed dramatically. I stood up. I don't think I meant to stand up, but I couldn't have kept from standing up. You know, I just stood up. And I looked around, and know. And I looked down, and the floor was 6 feet, 4 inches below me. And my right shoulder was out there, my left shoulder was out there. And the muscles were rippling through my body, you know. And that mind that had been filled with fear and doubt and everything all of a sudden was crystal clear. And I understood the big picture. And I said, but of course, it's so simple. Why didn't I see it before? It makes perfect sense to me now. And then I looked around that place, and my heart broke because that bar was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snibbling little men. You know, and all of them had women with them who were looking at me with their hungry eyes. You know how they do it. It's the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me. And my sponsor's Tom I. Some of you know Tom. Tom has a theory that, and part of the theory is that if I wanted to, I could have quit drinking then. And I said to him, who would want to? I mean, that's the greatest I ever felt in my life. It was without a doubt the best I ever felt in my life. For the first time, I really felt like I was home. And people would say to me, why do you drink? And I didn't know the answer until I got sober. But the answer is to get back to Pittsburgh. That was the greatest time I ever had in my life. I was there, I spent 6 or 7 hours just walking around that place, and people were saying, come and sit with us. We have so many questions we need answers to. Come and sit with us. And I'd sit down and I'd fill them in, you know, and they'd have all these questions. And it seems like the more questions I answered, the more questions they had. And it was time to leave. And it seemed to me like they were saying, please don't go, we've just discovered you. I said, no, I have to go and defend democracy. So I went and I got on the train. And the next morning I woke up and I was lying on the floor of this Pullman coach. And someone had wet the floor I was lying on. And whoever it was had wet me too. And I was 5 feet, 1 inch tall, and I weighed 113 pounds. Again, I was terrified. And I was in Washington, D.C., which is 300 miles from my home. And I had no idea what was going to happen to me. And some guy said, look, we're going to go over and have a few beers for breakfast. Do you want to come with me? And I said, what do I know? I'm from out of town. And I followed him over there, and the same thing happened. And that evening, I fell off a train in Yamasee, South Carolina, just a few miles from here. Somebody moved a bottom step or something, and I fell across the railroad tracks. And there was an extremely rude man there who was hurling obscenities at myself and the other young men who had gone down there to die for their countries. And I remember standing up and trying to explain to this cretin that he'd get a lot further if he treated us with a little bit of respect and dignity. He never caught on to the gist of my argument. The only thing I learned from that was I could do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's the only thing I learned. You know, you do push-ups, you turn your head, you throw up, you do some more push-ups. And so I was launched into my career in the Marine Corps. And I loved the Marine Corps. I really did. I always figured next to the nuns it was easy. You ever realize that the nuns have been blamed for more stuff than the Nazis? Yeah? Hang around AA. You'll find out. They're the ones who really damaged that child within, you know. It's the ruler. I mean, I knew. I was talking to dumb Denny one time, and I went up to make amends to Denny for God knows what. I was telling him, I said, you know, how about those nuns? He said, yeah. He said, weren't they something? I said, they sure were. I said, they used to beat my knuckles with a ruler, and they used to use the centimeter side. He said, well, I seem to remember some of that. He said, but, you know, what I mostly remember is that these were women who dedicated their whole lives just to teach ingrates like us. And I said, well, that's one way to look at it. But I really loved the Marine Corps. You know, I was going to stay 100 years if they'd keep me. I won Dress Blues Award, an Outstanding Man's Award off of Paris Island, and I got these meritorious promotions. And by the time I was 20 years old, I had an appointment to go to Officers Candidate School at Quantico, Virginia. And you know, I didn't take it. Instead, when my time was up, I got out. Because you see, I was alcoholic. And what being alcoholic means to me is that I will fall madly in love with something. And then over a period of time, I'll violate every principle involved with that. And my only way out is to blame them for what happened to me and run away. And that's what I did. I blamed the Marine Corps for why I drank on duty, why I led a patrol in a combat in a blackout. I blamed them for that because it was an abnormal way to live, and I got out. And that, to me, I think, is what alcoholism is all about. And I'm not going to bore you with a lot of drinking stories because my drinking wasn't all that exciting. It really wasn't. All I did was kill everything inside of me that mattered. I think that's what alcoholism did to me. I truly loved things, and I hurt those things. I truly loved being certain ways. I had marvelous examples. I had a father who's a shining example of what being a good human being was all about. And I tried to do the things he did, and I violated virtually every principle that there was. And the only defense I had was to blame them and to move on. And that's sort of my drinking story. I got married. I had two beautiful little daughters. I left a four-month-old daughter in a crib because I needed a drink so badly. And I never forget that night. I came back, and we were living in an apartment near the hospital where my wife worked. She was a nurse, emergency room nurse. And she said, "It was a terrible accident on the Beltway. They're calling all of us in. Your dinner's on the stove. I'm sorry, honey. Give Kelly your bottle. I love you. Goodbye." She ran out the door. And I thought, isn't that wonderful? I mean, that's really great that I'm married to a woman who has a profession she loves that much. And then I remembered there was no alcohol in the house. And I thought, well, Larry's always good for a drink next door. And I went over and knocked on Larry's door. And there was nobody home. Now I began to pace. Remember that? Should I, shouldn't I? Should I, shouldn't I? And Kelly wasn't feeling well. She'd been sick, so I didn't want to get her up and take her outside. And I guess about an hour and a half later, I kept looking in on her, and I kept pacing back and forth. And then I made the decision. And I know I didn't make the decision. My alcoholism made the decision. It was time for me to have a drink. And I ran out, and I jumped in the car, and I drove to the liquor store, and I grabbed a bottle of scotch, and I threw the money down. I didn't even wait for my change, and I drove back. And on the way back, I was thinking about things like crib death and apartment buildings burning down with children trapped in them and all this stuff that you think about. And I went running in, and I had that bottle clutched next to my heart, and I went running in, and I ran into the bedroom and looked at her, and she was laying there just breathing and doing fine. And then it started, you know, it. You're no good. You call yourself a father. What kind of a man are you? You're disgusting. You don't care about anybody but yourself. Probably not your child anyway. God wouldn't give a child like you to a person like you. And then I'd start drinking. And you know, about halfway through that fifth, I'd say, now wait a minute. You're being entirely too hard on yourself. The problem is you're married to a woman who thinks she's Florence Nightingale. That's the problem. And if she'd been here where she belonged, taking care of you the way she's supposed to take care of you, you wouldn't be going through this stuff. And then I'd finish that bottle, and by then she'd come home, and I'd just tell her what a loser she really was. And all she had done is gone to work because she was called there. And that's what alcoholism was to me. I mean, you know, and one day she said to me, you know, this can't go on. I mean, it was a zoo. I got to tell you, I really did learn about the affirmation. She was going to a psychologist, which explained why I was drinking the way I was, And he invited me to come in, and you know, I said, well, I'll do anything, it'll help her. And I went in there, and she had been obsessing about my drinking. And so I spent a few minutes with the man, and I said to him, I said, do you think I'm alcoholic? He said, certainly not. He said, but if you keep drinking this way, you will be. And I said, when? I thought it was important. I mean, after all, it was my life. And he got very upset with me. And he said, I don't know. He said, 2 years. And immediately I thought, well, I'll drink for another year and a half and quit in plenty of time. But he told me my problem was I had a poor self-image. So that was my problem. And what I needed to do was to be affirmed. And I needed to affirm myself. And so he gave me my very own affirmations. There were two pages of them, double-spaced, and it were from my history. So they were Keith's affirmations. And the instructions were simple. I was to stand in front of the mirror in the morning, and I was to affirm myself. If possible, my wife was to stand beside me to add to my affirmation. Well, I was so excited to find out I wasn't an alcoholic, I got very drunk that night. And evidently called my wife a lot of the names I used to call her, and she wouldn't stand beside me the next morning. So I had to do it by myself. And I remember standing in front of the mirror, looking in those yellow, bloodshot eyes, And the first thing said, Keith, today you're a winner. Today you're going to go to the hospital and do research. Today you're a great father. Today you're a wonderful husband. I got about halfway through and I looked in the mirror and I said, today you're full of crap. That's what you are. I mean, I might have been an alcoholic, but I wasn't a liar. So affirmation never worked very well for me. And she asked me to leave, and I went, and I ended up living in a basement apartment, a dive, in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., and I ended up drinking in bootleg joints. I ended up doing all the things that alcoholics do. None of it's terribly exciting. It's hard to romanticize wetting your pants. I mean, it really is, but you know, you'd be sitting on a bar stool minding your own business, and then you get that warm feeling, you know, and you knew you were numb from the waist down. It's hard to really romanticize that. You could say a bomb went on off outside or something, but, you know, it's hard. And so what's exciting, I think, isn't what happened when I drank. I think what's exciting was what happened when I came to you. And one morning I woke up and I had one thought in mind, and that was to commit suicide. I always thought suicide would be a big deal, but, you know, it really isn't a big deal. It's just the next thing. And the thing that strikes me about this, somebody said to me one time, what did your alcoholism cost you? And I said, well, you know, it's a silly question. It costs whatever it costs. Whatever it costs for the next drink is what it costs. You know, one day I went to the NCO club, and the guy said, what do you want? I said, give me a scotch and water. And I said, how much is that? He said, well, it's 35 cents in your Marine Corps career. I thought, well, that isn't too bad. And I paid it. And one day I went in for a bottle of gin, and the guy said $6.75 and your wife and children. I thought, well, if it'll get me back to Pittsburgh, and I paid it. And then one day I'm living in this dive, and I went and got a bottle of wine or something, and I said, how much is it? He said $0.69 in your life. I thought, well, that seems about right. And you know, it's really amazing to me that people will say to an alcoholic, how could you do that? Well, the answer is because it was next. And people who don't have alcoholism don't understand that. I mean, if you stand back and look at it, I'll admit it looks a little bizarre. But if you're trying to get back to Pittsburgh, no price is too great. And it was time to die, and I went into the bathroom to die. And I had just a cabinet full of pills. I worked in hospitals, my ex-wife worked in hospitals, and people noticed I had this nervous condition. I'd bang my eyes on a microscope. And, you know, they give me all these pills, and I never took the pills. I was afraid of them. I know there are people in this room who think that's the saddest story they ever heard, but I just never took them. And so I had hundreds of them, and I went in to take them all at once, and I put a bunch of them in a glass, and I don't know if I began to take them or not. I really don't. What I do know is I said out loud, I said, you're 29 years old, and at least it'll be over. And his voice outside of me says, when you're 29 years old, it's not supposed to be over. And it startled me. It was a real, live, tangible voice. And it was a woman's voice. And there was nobody there but me, so I thought. And I also remembered that this woman I had tormented and driven half crazy gave me two phone numbers when she asked me to leave. And she said, if you ever need any help, call these people. Maybe they can help you. Later, I found out that one phone number was to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the other was to a small treatment center outside of Washington, which is no longer there. And I just found one number, and I called it, and it happened to be the treatment center, and I'm eternally grateful for that. There are a lot of people who stand up who don't like treatment centers, and that's fine, but if it had not been for this place, I'm not sure I'd be alive. And I called and I said to the woman, I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I just didn't know what was wrong with me. I really thought I was crazy. And I think wanting to die proved that to me. And I said, if you can't help me, I think I'm going to die. And I think she could hear the desperation in my voice. And she said, give me your phone number. I'll call you right back. And I now know she was trying to have a way to get a hold of me in case I hung up. And I gave her the number, and I hung up, and I sat down on the floor, and she called back, and she said, you know, if you can come here Wednesday, maybe we can help you. And I hung up the phone, and I began to cry. I was just overwhelmed, and I looked over, and on a draining board was almost a full fifth of scotch. And I realize now that God gives all of us something special when we start this marvelous journey. And like John, it was... it was a family that loved him, and that, you know, a desire to do things. For me, the great gift was this thought. I knew that if I took one drink of alcohol, I'd die, and knowing that would never keep me from taking it. And I don't know where that thought came from. It certainly wasn't part of my repertoire, because the way I dealt with this was I used to go to autopsies. You know, they post autopsies at teaching hospitals, you know, like what somebody died of, sort of like coming attractions. And if you're interested in that, you could go watch the autopsy. And so I, when I'd see chronic alcoholism, or alcoholism chronic acute, I'd go and watch the autopsy, or at least I'd watch it as long as I could. I was trying to scare myself into drinking less. And I'd see that liver and, you know, that brain and all that stuff. And I'd go, ooh, you know, and then I'd stand it as long as I could. And I'd go down to Chadwick's or Clyde's and I'd say, Vinny, you better give me a double. You'll never guess what I just saw. And Vinny would say, we always get a double. And I said, well, you better make it a triple. And the rest of the intellectuals would be down there. And they would say, what's wrong? And I'd explain to them what I just saw. And they'd get a triple. And we'd sit around and wonder how anybody could do this to themselves. But I knew that day that I would never be scared into not drinking. And I knew that if I took one drink of alcohol, I'd die, and knowing that would never keep me from taking it. In other words, I knew I must drink again. See, I believe that what alcoholism is a disease that says I have to drink again. So I must drink again. There's a drink out ahead of me that has my name on it. It says Keith's Drink. Okay, that's what it says. It says Keith's Drink. I catch up to that drink. I'll drink it, because you see I'm powerless over alcohol. So what's required in my life is a miracle. And that's where you come in. See, you're my miracle. And here's how it works. Well, I hang around you. I go to meetings with you. I do the 12 steps. I get you to sponsor me. A few of you let me sponsor you. I get to go to hospitals. I get to do various things. I begin to push that drink out ahead of me. And I get it out there a few months. Remember in the beginning, it'd be out there 10 minutes. Remember that? Oh, 10 minutes. 5 minutes at a time. And I just knew at any minute I was going to jump up and run out and drink. You know? But then I'd push it ahead of me. I'd get it further and further ahead of me. And then I'd get comfortable. And I'd look around and I'd say, you know, what you need is some balance in your life. See, balance is a euphemism for cutting back on meetings, see. And I'd begin to seek balance, and then I'd start to gain on that drink, you know. I'd start to gain on it, and pretty soon I'd be sitting at meetings saying, huh, who died and made him king? Wonder why they ask him to speak. Same old nonsense he tells every time. He hadn't learned much in 20 years, on and on and on, and no wonder her husband left her. With a mouth like that, you know, just the usual caring attitude. And somebody would love me enough to say, you're on a dry drunk, what's going on with you? And I'd realize that what they said was true, and I'd throw myself back into the program, and then I'd push that drink way out ahead of me, and then I'd get comfortable. And my goal is to stay active with you until I'm about 100 years older. Now I'm going to quit at about 99, in case Sister Victoria was right. And maybe 6 months after I die or something like that, they'll say, whose drink is this? And they'll say, well, that's Keith's, but he died. You see, my goal is to die before I catch up with that drink. And I'll tell you, I know that that's true, because I've run into a lot of people. I get to go to a lot of hospitals and things and visit people who slip or who drink again or relapse, whatever you call it. And most of them will say, I don't know what happened. I just don't know what happened. And I'll say, I know what happened. You caught up to the drink with your name on it. If you catch up to it, you drink it, because you're powerless over it. I don't understand that. It doesn't matter. I'm not going there for them. I'm going there to see what happens to people who catch up to the drink that has their name on it. Because, you see, I must drink again, because I'm an alcoholic. You know, that a few days later, I somehow got in a car, and it took me 5 hours to drive to this place, and because I had the horrors. Remember the horrors? You could go about maybe a half a mile, and you begin to shake, and John described it so well. There's a lot of shaking going on up here during the readings. I was sitting there. I had sympathy anxiety sitting there. And of course, you know, reading's a lot harder than talking, because people know this material. There are some old-timers here who can't remember their wife's name, but they remember how it works. And they're waiting for you to make a mistake. You know they are. And if you make a mistake, you make their day. If you don't, they're mildly disappointed. But I had the horrors, and I wet my pants outside. I was throwing up outside the cart, shaking and everything. And I wet my pants, and I changed my pants, and my Phi Theta Kappa key fell out of my pocket while I was changing my pants. And I thought that was sort of an interesting irony. And, I had come a long way changing my pants beside an alcoholic car about 15 miles outside of Washington, D.C. And that's what I had done on my own. That was the very best. I 12-stepped a kid one time in a jail, and I was there when he woke up. I love that. You know, when somebody opens up and they realize that the ceiling isn't theirs. It's the first realization, oh my God, that's not my ceiling. I don't know that man sitting on the stool smiling at me. The last time I looked, there were not bars on my bedroom. And I said to this kid, I said, my name's Keith, I'm an alcoholic. I said, how's it going? And he sat up and he put his head in his hands. And he held his head for a minute and he looked at me and his eyes were full of tears. He said, Mister, my best efforts got me here. And I said, you're ready. Because I remember that. I remember the day I realized that the very best I could do got me with changing my pants off of Route 29 outside of Washington, D.C. And I was ready. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't like you. You were all much older than me. I just didn't care for your moralistic attitude. I didn't care for your rigidity. You know, I mean, just don't drink. I mean, don't, that's awfully rigid. I mean, how about drink less? Let's work our way into this. No, but you're just narrow-minded, rigid people. And I never cared for much of that, but you know what I did care for was the way you laughed and the sparkle in your eye and the bounce in your step. And what I really cared about was the fact that you cared about one another. It was an amazing thing to watch. And I knew I could never make it in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came in, it's only been be 20 years pretty soon. And about 3% of us were under 30 at that time. And I used to drive up, I'd leave work. And I was afraid that if I went home, I wouldn't be able to leave that little dive and go to a meeting. So frequently, I'd just go where the meeting was. And I'd sit in my car across the street from the meeting place. And from 5:30 to 8 o'clock, when you began to arrive, and I'd watch you. And you'd shake hands and things, and you'd pat each other on the back, and you'd say things. And I couldn't hear you because I'd be too far away, but I'd watch you. And you'd really be glad to see one another. And I was afraid of that. I was afraid that if you got that close to me, you'd find out I didn't belong there. And frankly, I didn't know where else to go. And then at about 8:30, when the meeting was ready to start, I'd run over there and I'd come in and you'd say to me, well, how are you doing? How do you like being sober? How do you like Alcoholics Anonymous? And I had an old idea, and the old idea was that if God finds out I like something, he takes it away from me. You know, I liked being a Marine, and that was gone. And I liked being a father, and I wasn't permitted to see my children anymore. And everything I seemed to like was taken away from me. So I was not going to let God know that I liked Alcoholics Anonymous, or I liked being sober, or I liked you. And then one day, when I least expected it, it just came out of my mouth. I was, about 2 weeks sober, and I came back from a meeting, and I had a roommate. Big Ed, he was the only guy in the place who was younger than I was. Big Ed was laying in bed, and I said to him, I said, you know, Ed, I said, I'd do anything to be like those people. I said, they're the greatest people I ever met in my life. And he looked at me, and he was really sad. He said, my God, Keith, he said, they've brainwashed you. And I got all excited. I said, you really think so? Because, you know, if anybody's brain needed washing, it was mine. And he said, you're going to end up just like them if you don't watch yourself. And I was all excited. That's the best news I'd had in weeks. And And by the grace of God, I have ended up an awful lot like you. Not like the old timers, but like some of you others. And I was so moved as John talked about AA. You know, that my mind was so messed up from alcohol. I mean, it really was. It never stopped running. It never did anything. But I think one of the most frightening times I ever had was I got up, I got ready to go to work, I got in my car, and I started to drive to work, and I couldn't remember where I worked. Yeah. And my sponsor's name was Dan, and Dan gave me a card, and he taped a dime to it. And he said, if you need me, call me. You know. And he had his home number and his office number, and I stopped, and I couldn't remember where I worked. I was struggling. I must not. I've worked there for a long time. And it was terrifying, and I called Dan. Well, I didn't want Dan to think I had problems, because I didn't think he'd want to sponsor someone who had problems. So I said, morning, Dan, how are you? He said, Keith, is that you? I said, yeah. It's great to be sober, isn't it? Or something I thought you were supposed to say, And he said, what's all that noise? I said, well, I'm calling you from a phone booth. He said, hey, buddy, did your car break down? No, car's fine, Dan, car's fine. I just wonder how you were doing. And he said, what's wrong, Keith? And I said, well, it's not much. I just seem to have forgotten where I were. And he said, oh, you have the old I can't remember where I work problem. He said, you know, a lot of us have had that. And, you know, I've been around AA almost 20 years. I've never met another person who had the old, I can't remember where I work problem. But he told me where I work. And he said, you work at Georgetown University? I said, of course. And I mean, you know, I mean, I'm just kidding. The minute he told me, I not only knew where I worked, I knew what I did. I mean, it's like all in one package, you know what I mean? And you either have all of it or none of it. It's one of those deals. And then he said to me, he said, it's kind of frightening when things like this happen. And he said, but you know, you've only been a couple months away from your last drink. And he said, things like this are going to happen when you're a couple months away from your last drink. And he said, don't let it worry you. He said, you know, you may not feel good now, but if your head hits a pillow tonight, you haven't had a drink. Today you're a winner. And I thought, that seems so simple, but it's so true. And you know, and I said, Dan, thank you. And he said, don't mention it. He said, may I make a suggestion? I said, anything. I'm honest, open, willing. He said, if you ever have this problem again, he said, let me suggest, if you can remember to do it, look at the front bumper of your car. You have a parking permit there. I remember driving to the hospital thinking, this is the smartest man. Where do they learn these things, you know? It's an amazing thing. You know, John was talking about fear last night, and certainly fear has dominated a large portion of my life. And if I don't watch myself, it will now. But fear then was that overwhelming fear that was just barely held at bay. And I spent my whole life doing that. And one of the reasons I know now is that I didn't know what to do about fear. I thought, and this was my idea, I thought that the way you dealt with fear was to be brave. I was in the Marine Corps. I have a fear of heights. I'll tell you how bad it was. Towards the end of my drinking, I convinced my ex-wife that I didn't like the ocean. Because if you live in Washington, D.C., to go to the ocean, you have to go over the Bay Bridge. And I would rather take a beating than go over that bridge. So I convinced her I didn't like the ocean. Boy, after I got, you know, I was sober while I moved to North Carolina, I bought a beach house. She went crazy. Thought she didn't like the ocean. So, I don't like bridges. I love the ocean. But I had this horrible fear of height when I was in the Marine Corps. So I started, well, you got to do something about this fear of height. Now, what you don't do is tell anybody. Because who ever heard of a real man who was afraid of heights? So you have to keep it a secret. You never let an old-timer find out about it. But so I looked around and I looked at things to do, and I said, jump school. certain percentage of Marines go to Army jump school to keep them straight. And I thought, well, I'll go to jump school, because if I can jump out of an airplane, I won't be afraid of heights anymore. Well, I had busted a kidney up shortly before that, overcoming another fear. And so they wouldn't let me go to jump school, so I went to mountain climbing school. So I was out in the Sierra Nevadas climbing mountains in the middle of winter with my eyes closed. I was either drunk or had my eyes closed when I'm climbing these mountains, and I came back from there more afraid of height than I'd ever been in my life, you know? But I thought that's what you did. You know, I was sober just a few months, and I got a letter from a professor at the University of Paris Medical School, and he asked me to come to, he's a psychologist, and asked me to come to Paris to study with him. And I knew that my sponsor wouldn't let me go. I just knew it. So instead of giving him the satisfaction of telling me no, I was just going to turn this guy down. And then I thought about it, and I said, well, so I called Dan up, and I said, I need to talk to you. So we got together for coffee, and I said, Dan, I said, I've been invited to go to Paris to study for a couple months. And he said, isn't that wonderful? I said, you mean I can go? He said, you must go. He said, you owe it to Alcoholics Anonymous and to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to take advantage of the gifts that God gives you. And I said, well, do you think I'm ready? And he said, you'll either be ready or you won't be ready. And he said, we'll smell the difference. And he said, now there are ways that we can go places and do things. And he got me in touch with people in the AA group in Paris. And somebody had been a member of the young group in D.C., worked for the embassy in Paris. And so I got to know all these people by mail before I ever went there. And everything was all arranged for me when I got there. And the strangest thing of all, I was there about 3 weeks, and he showed up, my sponsor. What a coincidence. He was just going through Paris. And he showed up, and we spent a week together, and I never forget, we're driving this train, we went down to Sark, you know that beautiful cathedral that was built by the alcoholic peasants? They lost the plans to this thing, and so the towers are very different. They just showed up every day at martini time and built. And they say this cathedral can't be standing. It's an archaeological wonder, or architectural wonder. It's not to an alcoholic, it's just the next thing to an alcoholic. So we're getting off the train and walking across this square, and I was all excited to be with my sponsor and to be sober. And he said, you know, this is a beautiful cathedral. And he said, you know, they have a catwalk that goes around the top of it. And if you get up there and bend over and look down, you can see the cathedral. You'll love it. And the old fear was back a height. And so I began getting brave, because that's what you do with fear. And finally I stopped and I said, Dan, I'm afraid of height. He said, oh, you got the old I'm afraid of height problems. He said, a lot of us have had that. And he said to me, he said, look, he said, you don't have to go up there. He said, your life won't change dramatically one way or the other. He said, but if you decide you want to go up there, he said, you can go part way. And I thought, there's a novel concept to go part way. And he said, and if you get tired or if you get frightened, he said, all you have to do is take my hand. And I learned how you deal with fear. You know, I went halfway up there, and I said, gee, I'm feeling a little queasy. He said, well, take my hand. And I took his hand, and I went clear to the top. Now, I didn't dance up there. I didn't lean out. But I got there, and I appreciated the beauty of it. And that's my story. I took your hand, and I went clear to the top. To me, that's what alcohol